employment law really encompasses a wide range of practice areas. Did the boss make sexual comments about the person? Dig a trench with, like, help on it in some way?
Welcome to Legal Aid Matters, a podcast from LAF, the largest provider of free civil legal services to low-income Chicagoans. On the show, we'll introduce you to the advocates that stand up for our clients, discuss how what's going on in the news affects our work, and share a few stories about how we use the justice system to fight poverty. Now, here's your host, Nubia Willman.
Welcome to Legal Aid Matters. Today we hear from John DeLozano, staff attorney in LAF's Immigrant and Workers' Rights Practice Group. Listen to John discuss how the Me Too movement is helping low-wage workers.
Maybe she doesn't think much of your intelligence.
That might be the case, actually. Oh, my gosh. So we are here with John DeLozano, who is a staff attorney in the Immigrant and Workers' Rights Practice Group. Thank you for being here, John.
You're very welcome.
A.K.A. John DeLorenzo.
Yeah, that's what I prefer to go by.
Thing.
Yeah.
Okay, this is alias. If anyone's Googling right now. Can you just give us a little brief introduction of the work that you do here?
Yeah, so I work in the Ready to Work Project in the Employment Law Group and the Immigrants and Workers' Rights Project. So my focus is on removing legal barriers to employment or to people getting a job or keeping a job, and to help people redress various employment violations they may have suffered in the workplace.
Okay, and so full disclosure, John and I are actually in the same practice group, and we have actually worked on cases together. We've been co-counsel a few times on a few different cases, so if you... I don't know. Well, maybe we'll discuss that later. Yeah. You can critique me.
Sure, yeah. We'll just go back and forth. I mean, I'm really hoping this devolves into us criticizing each other.
I think that'll be
trying to be as passive aggressive as possible.
That makes the most sense. And learn also, full disclosure, John is leaving us soon.
Yep.
Where are you going?
I'll be going to the EEOC.
A little group in the federal government.
Yep.
Yep. That's exciting here in Chicago.
Yeah.
So you'll be doing a little bit of what you do here, but now with a lot more tools at your disposal, or
I'm curious to see exactly how many tools I'll have at my disposal, but it will be a lot of the similar work, doing mostly employment discrimination work.
Okay, so we're gonna wow everyone with your knowledge, and then make everyone sad that you're leaving, as the whole group is already very sad that you're going leaving soon. But so you mentioned a few different types of employment law that you're doing. Employment, I do it a little bit. Not a ton. So I know that it's a very complex and complicated area of law. And when I first started, I really hated how the law seems to be really stacked against our clients, right? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of frustrating. And so can you talk a little bit about the complexities of employment law and why, if you agree with me, like, why do you think the laws are stacked against our clients?
Sure. So employment law really encompasses a wide range of practice areas. It can include discrimination. In the way that we practice at LAF, it includes discrimination, wage theft, unemployment, and also various medical leave laws, and even just a number of laws that restrict the employer's ability to terminate an employee for whatever reason. Broadly speaking, though, you can think of it as any kind of law that puts a restriction on the employee-employer relationship are the sorts of areas that we practice. So I think, especially when people think about the complexity of employment law, typically what they think of is discrimination. And the reason why is that, unlike a lot of kinds of areas, discrimination really depends on being able to prove a fact of a thing through insinuation and through making leaps of logic from acts that employers might do to acts that to proving discrimination. So, rare is the employer who will just call somebody a racial slur or fire somebody and say, "I'm firing you because you're a Christian," or list the actual reason why they're doing it. More often, what you have is that it's acts of discrimination are subtle. They often will come up, it's often the things that employers might say or do will be subject to interpretation. Mm-hmm. That even leads to questions of who's the employer, who is the person who made the comment? Does that person have the authority to make, you know, if is that person in the position of authority such that they're making the comment is discriminatory? Or if not, did the person report it? Did it rise to the level of the hostile or offensive work environment? Mm-hmm. Was there sufficient complaints? Were there sufficient efforts to redress it? And so I think that's really what it comes down to. It's employment laws, it's an impressionistic area mm-hmm. that requires the ability to prove facts when you don't have solid evidence, when all that you have is really human intuition, seeing mm-hmm. this is the sort of thing that a person might do if they didn't like this person for their religion, their race, their gender. And so for that reason, it's a fairly complex. I think wage theft ends up being a little bit mm-hmm. simpler. That's usually just a question of documents.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Did the person work? Did they keep track of their hours? How much were they paid? That sort of thing.
No, right. And so when I started doing discrimination work, sounds like I was discriminated when I started discriminating against people. When I started doing discrimination cases, what I found really hard to grasp was the standard, especially for the sex harassment, mm-hmm. where it has to be, one of them is the severe and pervasive standard. Mm-hmm. And if you could explain that quickly, and then we'll flesh out the other things you said as well.
Sure.
They're important.
So severe and pervasive, that arises in what's hostile work environment discrimination. So hostile work environment is one of those terms that's entered the popular lexicon, and I think people often don't really know what exactly that means. So a hostile work environment is, and it's not, it. You usually think about it in the context of sex harassment, but it actually arises under any number of protected classes. If a person is subject to harassment because they're a member of a protected class, and actually, maybe before I go on, describe what a protected class is. So a protected class is under Title VII and other state and civic discrimination laws, these statutes limit the ability of the employer to terminate a person because of their membership in a protected class. Some of those things would be race, gender, religion, national origin, age, pregnancy status, disability status. And a protected class isn't any particular race or any particular gender. It's if a person is being categorized as that thing within their class mm-hmm. and are suffering some kind of adverse employment action because of the categorization, then they are the victims of discrimination. Mm-hmm. So a hostile work environment would be if the person hasn't suffered any tangible adverse employment actions, mm-hmm. or if in addition to suffering adverse employment actions, they've also been harassed or bullied in some way, and to prove that by either their coworkers or their supervisors. And in order to prove that, you have to show that the harassment was severe and pervasive. And what that means is that it happened a lot, or it was particularly shocking. Mm-hmm. Typically, you know, a very occasional or one-off statement, or a statement that wasn't really direct, but that, you know, maybe the person took it a particular way but wasn't in fact meant to be discriminatory or was not on its face discriminatory. Mm-hmm. Those may not rise to meet the level. It's a fairly high standard.
Yeah, no, like I said, when I started, it was shocking to me just how high the standard mm-hmm. was, because I would hear stories, and we'll discuss the type of clients that we work with who are very particular kind of demographic. And it was shocking. And then we would look at the case law, and I was learning, and it would be told, no, that doesn't meet the standard. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, especially in employment, there's still like a long way for the law to catch up to what's happening in society.
Yeah.
And I think right now we're in a watershed moment with the Me Too movement, which is really putting sex harassment, especially in all industries, out mm-hmm. kind of the spotlight. And I think what ends up happening is that you hear all these things that have occurred, and then there's, like, no legal recourse, or there was, but the statute of limitations ran, and the statute of limitations was, like, a very small amount of time or something like that. So, and that, I think, can be especially difficult. It's difficult for anyone. It's difficult for someone who has access to an attorney. But for our clients, who tend to be low-wage workers, who are immigrants, it seems to be even more difficult because they don't have the resources to get an attorney. Mm-hmm. And so, do you want to talk a little bit about the type of clients that we work with?
Sure. So LAF, or our practice, that is yours and my practice, mm-hmm. is
the best practice.
Exactly, obviously, yeah. I mean, that's all I wanted to say, that our clients are the best, we're exactly. the best at it, we're, the, you know, it's great. But our clients, like all of the clients at LAF, are people who make, you know, are low wage earners in Cook County and beyond for certain mm-hmm. areas of law. But what makes our client population unique, that is both the employment and then the intersection of immigration and employment, is that our clients are often either are employed or were employed, which I think is not necessarily true of some of the other practice areas. Mm-hmm. What interestingly enough, what this means is that our clients tend to be relatively sophisticated in terms of their own rights mm-hmm. and the ability to access technology, access resources, those sorts of things. At the same time, though, a lot of our immigration and employment clients who are, you know, immigrants who are working in low-wage workplaces, whose supervisors often don't speak their native language, they, ironically, are quite a bit less resourced than mm-hmm. the average LAF client, I would think. You know, just by virtue of the fact that they lack access to resources in their own language, often lack access to technology and things like that that make it easier to facilitate finding a lawyer, making a complaint, or accessing resources. So that's really sort of, it's depending on how you sort of draw the lines between the client populations we deal with. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, our clients can either be relatively stable and relatively sophisticated or relatively lacking in resources, mm-hmm. depending on, you know, where they come from. Mm-hmm. But our clients, like all clients, even while I say relatively mm-hmm. resourced and relatively sophisticated, our clients are still low-wage workers. Mm-hmm. They are often the victims of wage theft, which means that even the wages, even if they were lawfully paid, the wages that they actually received don't reflect how much they deserved. So these are people who are often making below minimum wage, mm-hmm. People who have children and have to deal with health care, have to deal with paying rent, people who are not, who don't have access to public benefits at this point because they were working. Mm-hmm. They were working until their employer fired them, right. Until they realized, well, I can't do this anymore because I'm not actually being paid. Mm-hmm. So while I say that they're somewhat more resourced, it's still in relative terms.
Right.
In absolute terms, of course, our clients in immigration, employment, and the intersection thereof are just they simply don't have access to all those things that I think maybe you or I might expect if we were to be the victims of discrimination or the victims of wage theft.
And I think that's really important because, like, anyone who's listening to this might think, well, there's a private bar, there's employment mm-hmm. attorneys, discrimination is such a hot topic. Surely any case is going to be taken up by an attorney. But another thing that I realized when we were starting this is that, or when I started doing employment law, was that there's our clients, especially those that do not earn a lot, their damages and their claims, even for their wage theft, can be significantly low compared mm-hmm. to an average worker or in a professional job setting. And so it might not be resource effective or cost effective for a private attorney to take on the case. Mm-hmm. And we're able to do that, and it really makes a huge difference for our clients. But there are so many of them that we can't serve who miss out on being able to obtain even just a couple $100 in damages because they don't have an attorney available to do that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a really good point. I think, you know, the private employment bar is fairly active, and yeah. they do often take the plaintiff side private bar, mm-hmm. does take a fair amount of cases, but I think what you're pointing out is exactly right, that a lot of our clients, they're losing, you know, $2,000, $5,000, which isn't enough in an absolute sense to really be worth pursuing a case of that low damages. But to them, that's, you know, a few months' rent,
absolutely.
Enough money to get between the job they just lost and their mm-hmm. next job. And we sort of fill in the gaps in justice that are left by the transaction costs that litigation create.
Right, no, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about those types of cases that we do. We're here specifically to talk about the Me Too movement and with low-wage workers and the clients that we tend to see. Can you tell me, just in general, what makes, this is a weird way to phrase it, but what makes a good sex harassment case?
Yeah, and it, I think there is sort of that awkward mm-hmm. thought that it's, you know, oh, it's a good case because we have really good evidence that this person was. So, you know, what are some things that we look for when we're trying to prove a case? You know, we look at statements. We look to see if there's any kind of direct evidence of discrimination. So, mm-hmm. you know, did the person did the supervisor sort of engage, try to engage in some sort of transactional sexual interaction where they said, you know, sleep with me or you're fired, sleep with me and you'll get this raise. Did the boss make sexual comments about the person? You know, did the boss even say, you know, I don't like you because you're not feminine enough, something like that. Those could be signs. So you look at those comments. You look at timing. If a person, say, if a supervisor made a pass at his employer or his employee, and she complained about it, and soon after she was fired, or she rejected him, and soon after she was fired, then that could also lead to the inference that, you know, if this employee is doing well otherwise, and no condition here has changed except for her rejecting this advance, then that could be an example of, you know, that's some of the evidence we look for.
Right. And you mentioned, does it have to be a boss?
It doesn't have to be a boss, but if it's not a supervisor, then the under, as far as I know, under all of the statutes, the federal, the state, or the city or county statutes, the employee would have to have made the complaint to the employer about a non-supervisor engaging in sex harassment, and the employer would have had to fail to take action about that.
Right. And so when I started, that makes sense. Like, there's common sense as to why you should give your employer this, like, opportunity to correct this wrong. But it was so difficult for me to, because in most job settings, it's hard to complain even when, like, your coworker's annoying you, let alone when they're harassing you, right? When it's a real, because there's so much, and especially I think when you look at gender dynamics and people wanting to be nice and polite, it's really hard to go and do make that report. And the fact that the kind of law requires that, I think, is a big barrier that I think it's worth delving into. Like, you know, again, I haven't practiced enough to know, like, for certain, like, the law is this way because of how it is. But I was at a, I guess we're going to go all in. I was at a conference a while ago, and the person who mentioned, you know, the people who set these standards and make this case law and who are in these positions of power tend to be men. And so for a man, when you discuss, like, severe and pervasive, and you look at the behavior that's happening, it might be behavior, not to say, you know, of course not all men are harassers, but it could be behavior that they have seen or they have participated in, and they might themselves think, well, that's not so bad.
Yeah.
And so that to me is really interesting, because when we look at, we'll delve into the Me Too movement as to how it has impacted industries, it really, not a ton of it has come out in, like, the legal stratosphere as people, as to people being called out for their behaviors. But it's interesting because obviously sex harassment happens everywhere. And so are we looking at the places where, you know, important decisions are being made so that when we're moving forward with these tools, we're able to, like, combat it equally? I don't know. I mean, I've only heard about that one judge in California, I forget his name, who was, I think he retired, who was, like, accused. He's, like, a pretty, he has a complicated name that I can't say.
<That's right. laughs>
That he was accused by quite a few former clerks about his behavior, and he decided to retire rather than to, like, argue that he didn't do it.
Yeah.
But I really haven't heard of many other legal, in judges or anything that really have been called out for any type of.
Yeah, you really, I can't think of really any prominent examples other than.
I just think it's important to mention, because obviously, like, I mean, legislators make the law, but the judges are also, like, reviewing it and making the decisions. And if they, if we're all part of the problem, I think it's worth looking at. But anywho, we're going to talk a little bit more about the Me Too movement, as I keep mentioning. But before that, we're going to take a really quick break.
This is Casey Zeman, Grants and Data Administrator here at LAF. Our work makes a difference in the lives of more than 30,000 people living in poverty across Chicago every year. We rely on your contributions to provide the highest quality civil legal services to the most vulnerable members of our community. To support our work, please visit lafchicago.org/donate. Thank you.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, I saw Hoosiers.
Exactly. I'm a huge fan of Bobby Knight.
Yeah, he's not the best.
It's so great. All right. So we're back with John DeLozano. We're here to talk about the work we do in the Immigrant Workers' Rights Practice Group, and specifically looking at sex harassment cases in the Me Too movement with low-wage workers. So, John, I've mentioned Me Too, I think, a million times. So can you please tell the audience what is that, and how do we see it within the work we do?
Sure. So I think Me Too, broadly speaking, is the growing awareness of sex harassment in our society. I mean, I think that it was a grassroots social media movement. Mm-hmm. I think often as applied, it's, you know, thought about as sort of a movement within and among celebrities and people in the entertainment industry. And in fact, I mean, I think in some ways, just by virtue of the way that our society is, you know, people in the entertainment industry will tend to sort of suck up the oxygen when it comes to conversations about things like that. But that's something to think about, that, you know, are we sort of fairly distributing our sympathies and our concern about sex harassment through all levels of society? But regardless, I mean, I think that it's been a movement towards increasing the awareness and recognition of sex harassment in the workplace and finding ways to address it. One of the ways, too, that I think I find very inspiring is the Time's Up Fund, which funds organizations or people who protect victims of sex harassment in the workplace.
Right. And so we have been doing this work for a very long time. I mean, not you and I specifically. We're still very young attorneys, but the agency overall. And so we have always seen sex harassment, especially within the low-wage worker context. Can you talk a little bit, like, what do I mean when I say low-wage worker? Tell me what I mean.
So, I mean, you know, what's your typical low-wage worker? I mean, we think of it as being somebody who makes minimum wage or you know, maybe slightly over minimum wage, or makes more than minimum wage but doesn't work a full amount. Or somebody who maybe makes more but has, you know, a large family to support. The kinds of industries you might typically find the Cook County low-wage worker, or in particularly the Cook County low-wage woman worker. There'd be a lot in the service industry. There's some manufacturing. You'll often see in light industry. Temporary workers. Landscape occasionally for women workers, though our workers often come from landscaping, and sort of those sorts of professions, especially in the city. I think you'd often see service workers, just by virtue of the kinds of industries that are dominant in the city.
Right, and I think like one of the more like almost ever present type of workers, those that work in restaurants specifically, and then we do have a lot of hotel workers as well. And those seem to kind of really open themselves, the jobs, to vulnerability and to sex harassment. I think both in the restaurant and in the hotels, not just because of the employers and the coworkers, but also the guests, right, and the clients that come to those places. Yeah. So it's a really kind of overwhelming situation. And then, as you mentioned, most of our clients, especially in the restaurant, then they might only work for tips and not get a full wage, which can make things even more difficult. Because can you just remind us, what's the minimum wage in Illinois?
So the minimum wage in Illinois is $8.25. In Chicago, I believe it's $12 now.
Okay.
And in Cook County, it's, I think, $11, though, only if municipalities have opted in and most have not.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
And then, of course, it's lower if you are paid tips. And so the way that tips are measured is if you are in I think the Cook County or the Chicago minimum wage ordinance says if you're in an industry that customarily receives tips. So that usually is the service industry, particularly the restaurant industry. And of course, the problem with tips is that people pay with cash. And employers don't keep track of it in spite of legal obligations to do so. Employees don't keep track of how much they're being paid. And then at the end of the year, they receive a W-2, maybe. And that W-2 will reflect a wage. You know, did I actually receive this? Or this looks a lot higher than the amount of money I thought it took home.
Right.
And so that subjects it to a lot of, not only, sort of, it's inherently subject to exploitation, but it... I think a harasser would recognize that, you know, the employee who is being paid in tips is subject to, in some ways, to the arbitrary whims of the employer, and they use that to exercise control over the employees.
No, I would say like a tip worker, and even those making minimum wage, it's a very vulnerable situation to begin with. And then if you have to report, as you mentioned earlier, and you risk losing this job, it might not be easy to find another one. And so it you know, a lot of times people ask, like, why did someone wait so long to make a report, or why didn't they say something right away? I think there's often, from what I sense with clients, it's like hope that, you know, if I just ignore it, or if I hope, you know, that hopefully it'll just end, and that's generally not the case. And another big thing I've noticed is that when they do complain, what ends up happening is retaliation. Can you explain retaliation a little bit?
Sure. So retaliation would be any act that the employer takes to subject you to an adverse employment action because you've complained about discrimination, sex harassment, race discrimination, all that, or in fact complained about the failure to pay your legally entitled wages. But so it arises, and it, depending on the statute that you're bringing it under, it might arise if you just, if you simply report your employer and that employer fires you, or they take some action against you, cuts your hours, makes you transfer to a position that's objectively worse. Those are the sorts of things that can be tangible employment actions that they take because you filed it. One thing to keep in mind that's not retaliation is that if you're making a, or it's in a sense retaliatory, but it's not legally protected retaliation. If you make complaints about your employer who is sort of treating you poorly, but not for any reason that's protected under the law. So if your employer and you don't get along personally and they fire you for it, or your employer bullies you, but it's not based on race or gender or anything, and you report it and they fire you, that wouldn't rise to the level of legally protected discrimination or retaliation. But retaliation in the legal context means you make a legal, you're legally entitled to make a complaint of some kind. You make that complaint, and if the complaint results in the employer taking an adverse action against you.
I think that's like a thing that happens a lot with work, is that things happen and then people want to know, like, is this legal? And it turns out, well, yeah, it is. And I think when we look at the law, it's often based on this like reasonable person standard. And I think inherently as people in general, there's almost this like inherent cry and need for a certain bad behavior to be unlawful. And the law just, again, hasn't caught up with that, which I find kind of interesting. Can we talk a little bit about, like, what are the tools available for someone who has been retaliated against or who has been a victim of sex harassment? What are the next steps?
Sure. So I think the first thing I'd like to say is that, you know, to address the idea, like, why, you know, why don't people make complaints? A lot of times it's not clear to whom you make the complaint, where you make the complaint. A lot of times you're complaining about a boss who is the owner of the company. You're complaining about a boss who is best friends with the owner of the company. You're working for an employer who's too small to be subject to some of these employment discrimination statutes. And so there might be reasons why you don't make those complaints. And in a lot of ways, many employers don't make it easy. They don't make it clear. So one thing I would say to keep in mind is, whether you've been the victim of harassment or not, when you start a job, if you get an employee handbook, read the handbook and see what their procedures are. And to the extent possible and to the extent reasonable to do so, follow those procedures. That's going to put you in the best position if you are the victim of harassment or discrimination to sort of assert that claim, to show, look, I was doing everything right, and then they did this to me regardless. An important thing if you're the victim of sex harassment is to document the incidences of harassment. If it's, whether it's your boss or your coworkers, just write it down. And when you're keeping your notes, you don't even have to think about, is this really legally protected sex harassment? If there's anything that rises to, that offends you in some way, document it. And if you end up having to move forward, then you can, you know, you can sift through and say, well, that was, you know, this was just an employee or a coworker being rude. This was harassment. That was rudeness. That was, you know, this was both, that kind of thing. So keep documents as best as possible. Keep dates and times. If you make a complaint to your employer, do it in writing. And keep a copy for yourself, and keep a and note the date that you've made that complaint. That it just makes it easier for you to keep track of everything going on. If a person has made a direct comment in writing to you related to, say, by email or by text, keep those records so that you can show later on, this is the sort of thing I was putting up with when I was working in this place. A lot of times what'll happen, if a person works at a place with an internal internal email, they may lose access to that email after they've left. Mm-hmm. So if you think that that's something that might happen, keep track of it on your personal email, keep track of it on your personal computer. And it's just important, like we said at the beginning of this, mm-hmm. employment law is a fact-heavy situation where what you're trying to do is show... Prove things that you don't really have direct evidence to prove. You're trying to prove that these acts were motivated by an illicit motivation. Mm-hmm. And the more documentation that you have, the more power you have to make those to meet those standards. If you do think you're the victim of discrimination, and, you know, frankly, I do this work, and even... I think it takes a very brave person to be able to make a complaint against their supervisor. Mm-hmm. I think it is not easy to think, you know, things aren't good, but maybe they'll get better. So I'll just see if they pans out, or mm-hmm. you know, if I make this complaint, people are going to see me as the kind of person who makes complaints and that sort of thing. It's hard to do, mm-hmm. And realistically, oftentimes you make a complaint, it won't do anything, or worse still, you make a complaint and you're fired for it. But if, you know, just be aware of your right to make a complaint. And if something arises to the level of being discriminatory, or if something rises to the level of being so offensive to you that it's intolerable, or even before that, know who to complain to and make those complaints. Right. Document them and keep those documents.
And so say I have a good case and I go to an attorney. Are they going to run immediately to federal court and file a complaint for me?
So typically, no. Mm-hmm. There are some employment laws that would allow you to go straight to court. The wage theft cases typically let you go straight to court. Whistleblower cases let you go straight to court. Mm-hmm. However, most discrimination cases and most sex harassment cases require you to file with some agency before you can go to court. So that could either be in the federal system with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or in the state, in Illinois, if you're filing a discrimination case or a sex harassment case in Illinois, you do it with the Illinois Department of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. If you're filing it in Chicago, you can file with the Chicago Commission on Human Relations. Mm-hmm. And there's also a Cook County Commission on Human Rights.
That's what I noticed is that there were so many different avenues sometimes mm-hmm. for relief. But the process almost for every single one is very long. So if we have clients who've lost their job or are still in a pretty bad work setting, if they mm-hmm. haven't been fired, it's just such a long process. And part of it, I think, is just due to just trial work and legal work in general. But this is a long-term kind of investment when you decide you're going to make this type of complaint.
It is, and I think that it's important. I think that's a really good point. It's important to keep that in mind that filing a lawsuit is almost never going to be the immediate solution to the problem you're having right now.
Right.
I mean, it may be the immediate solution to getting them to stop harassing you if you're still working there, but mm-hmm. it's not going to get you, you know, that reinstatement or the money in any amount of time that you won't need to do something else. And an employment case is exhausting. It takes a long time to go through, like you said, and often it will not result in a positive outcome for the client, just because, you know, what you were pointing out earlier, the laws are often not favorable to clients. It's difficult to prove. So if you do want to move forward with a claim, you should go in knowing that it's going to be a long and difficult process, mm-hmm. and you may end up realistically at times getting nothing.
Mm-hmm. So with all that said, why did you decide you wanted to focus on employment law?
I think employment is, poverty law generally, the kind of work that LAF does is all really important. But mm-hmm. to my mind, work is itself a very important thing. It's being able to have financial independence in our society, or being able to support yourself, is such an important way, not only to have access to resources and access to those things which make life worth living. It itself is a way of... it's a way of giving of generating value and sort of mm-hmm. and sharing what your talents with the world by working. And you know, there are times where people are fired and there are good reasons for people to be fired, you know, obviously. Mm-hmm. And you know, but there's absolutely no reason why a person should have to go to work and fear that their boss is going to, you know, sexually harass mm-hmm. them, or, you know, or call them a racial slur, or mm-hmm. fire them because they're, you know, Hispanic. Mm-hmm. It's a fundamental unfairness, mm-hmm. and it takes away from people the one practicable means that they have to gain access to those things that we need to have access to, mm-hmm. food, shelter, all of those things. And employment facilitates those things. And so being able to work in an area where I get to help protect people's rights with their employer and against their employer, and guarantee that, you know, if they are the victim of sex harassment, or if they're the victim of race discrimination, they're being protected by somebody. Somebody's out there helping them, mm-hmm. you know, guarantee that they are getting some kind of protection. And I think it contributes not only to the clients themselves, but I think it sort of makes everything run better. It makes a better society if people not
no,
be
yeah. against. No, absolutely. And I think this is when I admit, since you're leaving, I often tell people you're like my Cyrano, because you know the case law in and out much better than I do. And I'm often maybe more the person on the phone kind of yelling, but then you're telling me in my ear.
No, I think that's what makes us a good team, because I think you've got that sort of killer instinct that I really can't. I just don't have it in me to, like, yell at somebody, but you got, you know, you know, have no qualms.
I have no idea what I'm going to do once you're gone. So for someone who's starting off and wants to become a poverty law attorney, because you've only been practicing for a few years yourself, mm-hmm. like, what do you suggest for someone who wants to enter this line of work?
Yeah, so I think find the areas that you're most interested in, but be flexible, because a lot of times, you know, it's hard to get... it's hard to get employment in nonprofits, but so be flexible, but find the areas you're interested in. If you can identify an area and identify an agency, try to work in that agency so that you're building those connections and things. Mm-hmm. If you're in law school, there's probably a dean, a public interest dean, who can help you direct you towards public interest work and help you make those connections. If there are public interest networking events and things, go to those. Mm-hmm. And typically, I think what employers are looking for, nonprofit employers are looking for, is to see that you're dedicated to serving the populations that they care about.
Yeah.
Because nobody does. And I think another thing is recognize that when you're doing this, you're not doing it for the money. You're not doing it for the fame or anything like that. You're doing it because you care about the kind of work that you're doing.
Right. No, absolutely. Okay, so we're almost out of time. I wanted to ask just two fun questions. One is, if you were stranded on a desert island, tell us, how would you escape? So people should know that John is probably one of the more savvier attorneys in our practice group, who is very wily and smart. Take that as
wily?
A compliment.
Yeah, I think that's... I'll take
so
that.
I'm really interested to know, how would you escape this desert island?
So, okay, well, so what's the scenario? So I'm on like a
desert island.
And I'm assuming this is like the standard Looney Tunes tropical island.
Yes, all by itself.
Yeah, just all by itself, a single palm tree, mm-hmm. one coconut.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like swim for it probably isn't a practical solution. I guess, like, dig a trench with, like, help on it in some way.
Oh, okay.
You know,
hopefully
maybe
someone flies overpass.
Yeah. I mean, I read Hatchet as a child, obviously, so, I mean, that gave me, I think, a pretty solid survival background.
It's a pretty good book.
I think it is, yeah. you know, maybe hope that there are matches. Don't fly over international waters. I think that's, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, right? So I just won't fly anywhere where there are desert islands.
Don't go to the Bermuda Triangle.
Nope.
I'm going to tell you what I would do, uh-huh. which I think plays off nicely on our good cop, bad cop,
sure.
is that I thought I would set the island on fire, just like swim out in the water and save myself, because certainly an island that just like self-combusts is going to make the news. Like, someone's going to come see what's happening. You know,
well, okay. So, okay, here, I think I can think of at least three problems with that.
Okay, so
first of all, what happens if nobody does come? Where are you going to stay while the island is on fire? Well, A. B, how are you going to set the island on fire at all? I mean...
I read Hatchet also,
that's fair.
How to start
all right.
a fire. There we go.
All right,
okay.
Asked and answered. I understand. But,
all right.
But what if... And also, I feel like stuff happens on desert islands all the time, and it's not like, you know, this just in on desert
know.
Island news.
I think it would make the news.
Spontaneous combustion
I think
island.
So, yeah. Like, yeah. Hey, what's happening over there? And then I'd be safe. I think that's the right way
all
to
right.
go. So, last question is what I ask everyone who comes here, and that, why does legal aid matter to you?
Legal aid matters to me because you know, serving low-income clients in order to gain access to justice, there are high transaction costs. Mm-hmm. You know, in a perfect world, court and law would be simple and free, and people could understand it and assert their own rights without having to go through an attorney. But the reality is that the law is a complex process. In order for you to be protected by the law, you have to have somebody who's going to be there to advocate for you and guarantee that you're being protected in the way that you're entitled to, you know, as a human being. And I think without legal aid, there already is even with legal aid, but without legal aid, there would just be a vast number of people who would live and work and be the victims of sex harassment and lose their housing and, you know, be denied public benefits or have their kids taken away from them with absolutely no recourse. Mm-hmm. Because the law is complex and you need somebody there to advocate for you. And that's why I think it's really important, the work that we do here.
Yeah, no, I agree. So maybe by the time you listen to this, John will no longer be with us. He will be at the EOC.
Yeah, the better place.
Better place. So I want to thank you so much for coming on here, and I want to thank the audience for listening, and we will see you in the next episode of Legal Aid Matters.
This has been Legal Aid Matters. We are produced and edited by Ronald Tippin and me, Davis Sullivan. Our music is by Poddington Bear, and our host is, as ever, Nubia Bowman. The first ever Chicago edition of Law Rocks is on September 27th at Lincoln Hall. It's a Battle of the Band style fundraiser to benefit local nonprofits, and one of those lucky local nonprofits is LAF. If you'd like to come out and join us, tickets are available at lawrocks.org/CHI. Thanks, we hope to see you there.